This evening we're looking at the second of the four Brahmaviharas that the Buddha taught about. In fact, this is one of the four major practices in Theravada Buddhism, you know, anapana, mindfulness of the breathing, insight meditation, vipassana, and metta, or the Brahmavihara practices, and the jhanas, or meditative absorptions. So I'd like to speak a little bit this evening about how the Brahmaviharas got their name and why we call them what we do. They're also referred to as the four immeasurables or the divine abodes. And it goes back to an encounter that the Buddha had with a young Brahmin student named Subha, S-U-B-H-A. And the story is drawn from the Subha Sutta, which is number 99 in the Majjhima Nikaya. At the time of the Buddha, the dominant kind of religious tradition in India at the time was Brahmanism. And it was pretty tied up with the caste system. And so there are these relatively hierarchical castes at the time in India, and the top caste were the Brahmins, were the priests. They were responsible for the spiritual well-being of their communities and for society in general. And the tradition of Brahmanism or Hinduism is theism. And like other theistic religions, okay, or understandings of how things work, right? The sort of the goal is to of the individual person is over time through practice and earnest commitment to the teachings of whatever that tradition is to attain union or one with the Godhead. To bring Jesus into your heart to, you know, experience the Trinity, or, you know, different traditions go at it in different ways. But in almost all of them, there is posited a external, omnipotent, omniscient being with whom or with what one seeks to attain union. And so it was with, and is, with Brahmanism. The way it had gotten admingled with the caste system, the configuration of the understanding is there is Brahman, you know, the Godhead, and then there is Atman, which is sort of the individual spark of the divine within each of us, right? This soul is a pretty good approximation. And in the understanding of Brahmanism, in the practice of reincarnation, in each incarnation, in each life, one seeks to purify oneself in order to make it increasingly likely that Brahman and Atman can be one, can be unified. And the way it got mixed up with the caste system at the time is that the Brahmins were teaching, well, you know, anyone can have a shot at it, but the way you really get there is you do your job as you are told to do your job within your caste, and you obey all the observances and all the practices and do what the priests tell you, and it might be that you'll be fortunate enough to be reborn in a higher caste. And then keep it up next few lifetimes, and sooner or later maybe you'll get to be a Brahmin. Okay, and of course you have to be a male Brahmin in order to actually be chidiyaning with Brahma, but at any rate, that was one of the things that the Buddha really found kind of irksome. He really didn't have good feelings about the way the caste system and Brahmanism had gotten kind of all intermingled, which is why, in his order, it was open to anyone from any caste. Throughout the discourses, wherever the Buddha is talking about, or the person who is describing the situation in which the Buddha was teaching, they would say various Brahmins and recluses. That's how they would normally or oftentimes talk about the spiritual seekers who wanted to try to learn what it was that the Buddha had to offer. Those are two relatively distinct classes of people. Okay. The Brahmins were the Brahmin priests. They were the ones born to the Brahmin caste. They were the ones being trained to be the spiritual leaders of their communities or their society. Recluses could come from other castes. And they were the ones who, rather than, you know, the Brahmanic practices of learning the rituals and the hymns and the chants and the things they were supposed to be telling others, would actually sort of go off into the forest, and they would sit with various teachers and they would learn what they had to offer, and there was a lot of introspective meditation and whatnot. And the Buddha was born to the Sakya clan, which was a subset of the Kshatriyas, the ones who were the warrior caste and the government leaders. His father was a king of a small fiefdom. And so when he went on the road to undertake spiritual seeking, he was a recluse. He went into the forest, okay, and learned what he could from the various holy men who were in his part of India at the time, the various sort of kind of implements for a spiritual toolbox. When Subha, the student, the young Brahmin, comes to visit the Buddha, he had been asking around when he was in this particular part of northeastern India, kind of on the road, are there any people around here who seem to have kind of got the hang of it, you know, or people who are understood or recognized to be somewhat spiritually realized? And everyone said, yeah, you should go hang out with this guy, you know, Gotama, you know. And everyone says, he's really far in LA. And so he sort of asked around, and some of the Brahmin elders said, oh, this guy's a loser, he's clueless, he has no idea what's going on. And others would say, yeah, he's the real thing. You should really go spend time with him. And so when Subha meets the Buddha, he says, even though you are not a Brahmin, I have heard that you actually have attained the ability that all Brahmins strive for, which is to actually follow the path to union with Brahma, to visit with Brahma, to reside in the abodes of Brahma. Sort of thing is only thought in his tradition to be accessible to very senior, very realized Brahmins. And the Buddha said, yes, this is true. Even though he had, you know, extraordinarily mixed feelings about how Brahmanism was being practiced, he was trying to use an idiom or a language that Subha would understand. Okay. And so he said, yes, these people who say so are correct. And he said, yeah, but, you know, some of the Brahmins say that recluses don't have a clue because they don't know all their chants, and they don't know all their rituals, and they don't know all the hymns, and they haven't done the proper propitiation, the kinds of things that are basically only available to a Brahmin, and therefore it's impossible for anyone who's not a Brahmin to actually be realized. So then the Buddha asked, well, okay, among all the Brahmin elders that you know, are there any, or first off, he said, well, what are they teaching you anyway? What are some of the kind of the virtues or tenets of your religion that you were told to practice? And he said, well, there's truth-telling, and there's generosity, and there's renunciation, and kindness. And the Buddha said, these all seem, you know, very skillful, very useful, okay, what he called, you know, tools for mental development. And he said, and who among all the Brahmin priesthood do you know who has used these rituals or cultivated or attained these states of mind to the point where they are, in fact, on occasion, one with Brahma? And Subha thought about it, and he said, none of them have a clue. Essentially, he said, they talk the talk, but they don't seem to know how to walk the walk. You know, they've really got the chants down and the hymns down and their rituals down and the alms collecting down. And I said, that's all great. But he said, I see very little in the way of fruition, to tell you the truth, which is why I'm hanging out with you, because you and your people seem to be much closer to what it is that's espoused in my tradition, even though you're not part of my tradition. And so I want to know kind of how you did it, how you got there. And so what the Buddha said in response was actually a pretty close parallel to what Jesus of Nazareth said when he was asked a similar question, which he said, you know, it's when there were these different teachings and different sects and whatnot. He said, how do we know who is righteous? And he said, by the fruits of their labors, you'll know them, right? And the Buddha was saying the same thing. It doesn't matter what the teaching is. There are a lot of teachings out there. They're pretty virtuous. But when you can judge for yourself what you consider to be the authentic teaching or the right path, the way you'll know that it's the right path is the effect that it has on the people who follow it. And then he explained to Subha, the reason that it seems to you or feels to you like I and my followers have in fact found out how to be one with Brahma. And here he is, you know, basically again using Subha's language to explain something that's not really within the Brahmanic tradition. He said, the attainment of oneness with Brahma, of being able to be in the abode of Brahma, to reside with Brahma, that is not something that occurs outside of yourself. He said the abodes of Brahma, the houses of Brahma, the place where Brahma resides, is within your very own heart mind. There are these spaces within your consciousness that are there waiting to be cultivated, waiting to be opened up and dusted off and furnished. And he said, they are these four abodes, these four kind of sheltered spaces, these four refuges within your own mind, that when you find out where they are and you find out how to cultivate them, you can go to those places anytime you want to. One of them is the abode of metta, or loving kindness. And when we were doing the Karaniya Metta Sutta last time we were together, he was saying, you know, using this sutta, using the images that are in this teaching, are a way to cultivate the open-heartedness, the loving kindness that in fact is one of the Brahma Viharas. Vihara means house or home or abode, holy space. So the cultivation of loving kindness comes from, you know, may I be happy, may I be peaceful, may I be free, let no one deceive another. As a mother watches over her child, willing to risk her own life to protect her only child, so too with a boundless heart may we cherish all living beings, suffusing all living beings, suffusing the whole world with unobstructed loving kindness. So what he's saying is, it's not me, little old me alone, or singly by myself going to be with Brahma. It is me opening the heart mind to the point where that kind of selfless union with all beings becomes possible. So we can think about compassion, or karuna, which is the Pali and Sanskrit word for compassion. Literally means quivering of the heart. You know, like if you pluck a string on a harp, then sometimes the harmonic string up and down the scale will quiver as well. It's like that. It's like being with the heart of another, you know, in a quivering state. So what he's saying is that when you're in that state of mind, essentially the self has disappeared. We can think of compassion as a selfless open-hearted, caring response to suffering, whether it's your own suffering or that of another, you know. An open-hearted, selfless, caring response to suffering. And that modern bodhisattva, Albert Einstein, described it this way, even though I don't know whether he even ever read the Dharma book, but just based on his own vision, he said, a human being is part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. We experience ourselves, our thoughts and feelings, as something separate from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circles of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. So, a little bit of that flavor, you know. And that's why another of the names or words for the divine abidings is the four immeasurables. And by that, the Buddha means states of mind that, when cultivated, allow one's consciousness to expand beyond the confines of the discursively constructed self. Outward and unbounded, as the Buddha says in the Metta Sutta. So that it's possible, when you reside in one of these spaces and are cultivating, you know, these qualities of the heart-mind, whether it's selfless joy or compassion or open-heartedness or equanimity, to find yourself in a situation which the self seems to get soft, seems to become porous, and maybe for a little while even just kind of dissolves or relaxes, so that the heart and mind can just kind of continue to expand, touch others. Nice work if you can get it. Any reflections or questions or comments or experiences you want to share on anything I've said so far?
I have a question.
Please.
What does Sangha mean?
Sangha is a word that has various interpretations depending on the context. The simplest explanation in terms of how it's used here in the West in this day and age is spiritual community, gathering of people to practice Buddha Dharma. Yeah. Okay. Okay. No, thank you. Good question. Please, here.
Question. So you were talking about the definition of compassion as the quivering of the heart. Where does that definition come from?
I think it's the literal translation of the word karuna. I don't know beyond that. Actually. Yeah.
Isn't the... Oh, I was... Go ahead.
When you're using the word suffering, is that the suffering that's the layer on top of pain?
Thank you.
Does it matter?
Thank you for helping unpack that a little bit. Because it may have sounded a little paradoxical in the phrases I was using. You know, I was saying, you know, may I live with ease, safe from all inner and outer harm, and may I be free from all physical and mental suffering. And, you know, as I think you're probably alluding to there, should have read the fine print before we took delivery on these things, because along with this two mortal coil comes a certain amount of physical suffering. You know, and in as much as we're social beings, we experience mental anguish as well, of all kinds, right? It seems to just come along with the territory. And so it's an aspirational kind of wish or generous intention. May I be free of physical and mental suffering. May others be free of mental and physical suffering. Knowing full well that we're going to experience them. And so then that's why that next phrase, may I acknowledge and accept any physical or mental suffering that I find in myself or in others with courage and with caring and with kindness, because those are sort of constituent elements of compassion. Right? May I take in, acknowledge the suffering, whether it's my own or somebody else's, with these qualities of mind, instead of being shriveled by them, shriveled by the pain, contracting away from the pain, isolated by the pain, which only makes it worse. So may I acknowledge, and it doesn't mean approve, but just acknowledge the reality of the suffering when I see the suffering to exist, whether it's my own or somebody else's. And then when the following phrase, may I be free of suffering and the roots of suffering, it's what the Buddha called the first and second error, or first and second error. You know, the first one is the experience of physical or mental suffering. The second one is the aversion to the experience of suffering. And so when the Buddha says the roots of suffering, that's what he's talking about. To be a human being is to experience dissatisfaction or distress, which are probably both better translations of the word dukkha than the use of the word suffering. To be a human being is to occasionally experience dissatisfaction. Okay? You haven't eaten for a couple of days, you tend to experience dissatisfaction over the fact that you're hungry, right? And you're starting to get a little bit worried about your survival. So just being in a body that has appetites and has needs, right? Being a social being that's with others and is affected by how others are, by your own states of mind. Those are, in fact, you know, the places where different kinds of dissatisfaction, distress, pain come from. It's how we relate to that pain that makes all the difference. Yes, please.
Can you speak more about the aversion part? So aversion to...
Yes. So one way of thinking about the word dukkha or dissatisfaction, distress, anguish, sometimes translated as, is the experience of wanting things to be different than they are. So that's the experience of the difficult, that which is difficult to bear. Another translation. The second layer is aversion to the aversion.
that's the part that tripped me up.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And so part, it's like peeling the layers off an onion. So part of the practice is, okay, I don't want things to be the way they are, but they're that way anyway, and I hate it. And so you're going after the second phrase when you're starting to look at your practice. You know, may I be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May I begin to see through or be aware of and accepting of my wish that things were not as they were. Mm-hmm. And so then you're just getting back to the base layer of, wow, this really hurts. I sure wish I didn't have cancer. Or this really hurts. I sure wish I could find something. You know, so it's just the bare experience of not wanting things to be the way they are. But at some level, being understanding and almost accepting of why it is you're suffering. Simply because you're in a body. Simply because, you know, and bodies are hardwired to hurt when something's wrong. It's how they work, you know. If we didn't hurt, we wouldn't have survived as a species. So it's really useful information when your body's telling you something ain't right here, you know. And it wants you to do something about it, and sometimes you can and sometimes you can't. So learning to be with the difficult without aversion is a masterful state of mind. It's, you know, it's one of the definitions of equanimity. And this one is something you cultivate, yeah.
So where does the right to die issue come in here?
Say more. What's, you know, in terms of the question?
Well, the way I look at it, it kind of just eliminates the suffering for one.
Yes.
It puts a stop to it. So
yes.
I just, you know, with the Buddhist tradition, I'm not sure, is it something that would be acknowledged?
Same thing arises with regard to the question about the elective termination of an unwanted pregnancy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Because one of the teachings of the Buddha is, you know, to respect life, you know, the well-being of all sentient beings.
Right.
And so then comes the question of what does it mean to respect all sentient beings if they're undergoing intolerable suffering? And the Buddha himself didn't have an answer for that one. It's left to each of us, essentially, to sit with what does compassion for all sentient beings consist of at any given point in time. Right? And we're all kind of, you know, have my own views on that, you know. I'm sure glad that law passed in Colorado is basically my view. If I find myself in a situation of intolerable pain, I really would look forward to having that option. In part because it's being recast as, re-understood as, a form of medical care, palliative care. It's how much, for someone who's going to die of excruciating death anyway, it's like how much more suffering they need to do, or they can do it. Please.
Are the phrases a wish, an intention, a prayer? I struggle a little bit with.
Of course. In the theistic traditions, it's easy. You know, you're praying to God, give me a hand here, right? Things are really messed up, and I could, you know. And it's like, yeah, because the language sounds as if it is of a beseeching nature. Right. And the languaging is really key here, because what the Buddha said is that that's not what you're doing, right? This is not Brahmanism. This is not you asking Brahma to make you more compassionate, or you asking Brahma to make you happier, or you asking somebody else to give you something that you want that you don't have. What he's saying is that it's more like gardening. That, that's a simile the Buddha used a lot. It's a simile that is used a lot by like the Thai forest meditation masters. You know, Ajahn Chah was very fond of that one. He said, you know, it's just like you've been given this garden patch to till, and you've been given some seeds, and you are working in partnership with nature. You know, and you till the soil, and you put the seeds in, and you nourish them, and you weed the place, and you make sure they get enough water. And he said, and then after that, you can't make corn come up. whether it does and what form it takes is something that's actually rather beyond you. So you are working in partnership with natural forces. And so that is, you know, for me, that's a pretty good explanation. You're working with yourself, ultimately, but what you're working to do is to entrain a universal energy. As you're saying it's the spiritual birthright of all of us, that these seeds lie within us. And it's just a matter of learning how to cultivate them, learning how to help bring them forth.
It sounds a little like the Christian concept of grace, where the source of grace is God in Christian tradition, but it's something you can't make happen. Mm-hmm. All the praying in the world won't do it. All you can do is be receptive to it. Mm-hmm. And so grace, you can almost use the word without positing a divine being. But I like that connection.
Right. It's working in, it's learning how to work in partnership with what some would call your own true self or your own Buddha nature. Getting out of the way of the Dharma is another way I've heard it expressed, you know. And it is an expression of intention that, you know, the Buddha taught the Brahmaviharas for the purpose of helping to overcome or diffuse or disempower unwholesome states of mind. You know, function of the cultivation of compassion is to help overcome cruelty. You know, function of the cultivation of selfless joy is to help overcome envy. Function of the cultivation of loving kindness is to overcome hate. Please, question.
Is this a skillful way of bringing things to the table to deal with other people appreciating as well?
Yes. Yes.
Are they suffering?
Anyone, you know, offering metta to another who is angry or malicious or whatnot, it can be really difficult to do, especially if they're being angry or malicious toward you, you know. And yet, the reason they're acting the way they are is because they're living in a hell realm, basically. And they don't know how to escape it. So if by, you know, all you're doing is inclining your own mind, you can't make them be different than they are, okay? But in the event something in them begins to awaken to how much hell they've created for themselves and others, then they might cease to inflict suffering on others. So in offering them loving kindness or feeling compassion for them, even though they're causing enormous harm to others, all right, then you can understand to some extent what's going on in their own minds because you understand what it feels like when you feel that way. It doesn't mean approving of how they're behaving. And in fact, sometimes it means being able to arouse sort of fierce compassion, you know. I've written a couple of books about the natural resource rights of American Indian tribes, and recently I've taken on this job of being an environmental historian at Bar Lake State Park and teaching about the history of indigenous peoples here, which inevitably results in teaching about the things like, well, why aren't there any Arapaho and Cheyenne in Colorado anymore? And it's, well, there was this massacre in 1864. Where the army wiped out whole villages of friendly Indians and basically tried to commit genocide on the Colorado Prairie, and it triggered a decade-long range war, that, you know, from New Mexico to Montana. And I was out at the Sand Creek Massacre Memorial Service for one of the members of the military who refused to allow his men massacre the people at the village, Captain Silas Soule. He's buried out at Riverside Cemetery. Every year at this time, the Arapaho and Cheyenne peoples get together out there, and they honor the fact that he wouldn't let his people wipe them out. He wrote a letter to his commanding officer, Ned Wynkoop, who then reported to Washington what had happened. And they came out, and Congress held hearings out here, you know, military commission held hearings out here, and they found that John Shivington, the colonel who'd ordered it and led it, was, you know, a butcher, and he resigned from the army so he could avoid being court-martialed. The governor who had ordered the attack, John Evans, President Johnson suggested that he resign immediately as governor of Colorado, which he did. And so how do I, you know, I was having a hard time today holding in my heart and knowing I was going to be talking about compassion tonight when there are these brutal things that went on, and what to do with that one. And one of the people, one of the historians who spoke today, the way this whole thing, you know, when Captain Soule blew the lid off this thing with the letter he wrote, he was assassinated 3 months later. Yes. By one of Shivington's men at 15th and Arapaho down here. That's why they honor him. You know, he lost his life trying to protect, you know, the Arapaho and Cheyenne peoples. Mm-hmm. There is a bill pending in Congress that was trying to establish the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site out near Eads, Colorado. And it was kind of bogged down. It wasn't going anywhere. The Colorado congressional delegation was split on whether to pass the bill, because the ones who didn't want to pass said, well, you know, that was an awful thing, but that was then, and here we are now. We've got to put the past behind us and forget these awful, horrible things that happened in the past. It causes people to not respect government. And, you know, there was really a lot of pushback against establishing that. And then these historians were looking around for more documentation of what actually happened there. So Major Wynkoop had reported these things had happened. And it was in the military record, but not very much detail. And somebody, and they were in private possession, these letters that had been written by Silas Holland and Wynkoop and Joseph Kramer, and somebody gave him these historians who got him to Senator, you know, Ben Nidors Campbell, Colorado Senator, and he read the letters are gory and horrible, and they go into a lot of detail of the atrocities that were committed on the, you know, the women and children were murdered and whatnot. And he read every word of these letters into the record, and after he read them in, the congressional committee voted unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
To pass the bill into law. And the reason, some of the pushback had said, well, you know, it wouldn't be compassionate to have to continue to share this gory history going into the future, you know. And the response to that ultimately on the part of the Arapahos and the Cheyennes and Senator Campbell and the congressional majority, oh no, you know, this is the most compassionate thing we can do. As difficult and as painful and as heavy as this is. And the reason that Senator Campbell gave, he said, you know, we remember these things, we hold them, not because we hold a grudge, but because we hold the hearts of our elders in our hands going forward, and we need to make sure that nothing like this ever happens again in the future. And the only way to make sure that doesn't happen is to remember that it did, okay? And so, for that reason, we hold these memories, you know? In 2014, Governor Hickenlooper, on behalf of the state of Colorado, formally apologized to the Arapaho and the Cheyenne. And so now these memories are held as part of an ongoing healing process. And it occurred to a lot of us who were participating in the ceremonies today that it may be that we need these memories now more than we have needed them in a long time, because there are things we really need to come together to make sure never happen again. And that, ultimately, as difficult as it is, can be a profound gesture of compassion. Let's go back to sitting posture. Just one moment. Okay. May we all live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we all be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we all be free of physical and mental distress. May we acknowledge and accept any mental or physical distress that we experience or that we see in each other with courage and with kindness and with caring. May we all be free of suffering and the roots of suffering. May we all be awakened. Have a safe journey home.